Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight.
It was 1938, late in the Great Depression, and on the quiet campus of Indiana University, Dr. Alfred C. Kinsey began to revolutionize the way Americans thought about sex. His wildly popular Marriage course talked about human sexuality with a frankness that would take the campus, and ultimately the country, by storm. In an era when talk about sex was taboo, students flocked to his class. Many sought advice from Professor Kinsey on sexual matters, giving him unprecedented access to their sexual histories. Recording and documenting sexual histories in 18,000 face-to-face interviews by himself and his staff over the years would catapult Dr. Kinsey into enormous notoriety and give birth to his groundbreaking Kinsey Report, the first comprehensive modern survey of human sexuality. His volumes on male and female sexual behavior became huge bestsellers, the biggest since Gone with the Wind, and were even immortalized in the Cole Porter song, Too Darn Hot.
According to the Kinsey Report, every average man you know much prefers his lovey-dovey to court when the temperature is low. But when the thermometer goes way up and the weather is sizzling hot, Mr. Pants, for romance is not, 'cause it's too darn hot.
Now, decades later, at a time when cultural forces are again pushing back against frank talk about sex, the story of Alfred Kinsey and his research is capturing the imagination of Americans once more. In the new movie, Kinsey, that opens today, starring Liam Neeson and Laura Linney, tonight on Point, the life and legacy of Dr. Sex, Alfred C. Kinsey. Joining me now from Benham, England, is Kinsey biographer Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy. He is author of Kinsey, Sex, the Measure of All Things, and served as a consultant during the filming of the new movie, Kinsey. Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
It's nice to be with you, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you. Here we are, a lot to talk about. We want to revisit the history of this remarkable, controversial man, but I have to ask you, just to start, in this week, when the Texas Board of Education has essentially banished sex education from textbooks there, and of course this will have influence all over the country, they said they only want to talk about abstinence. Are you hearing an echo of the straight-laced time in which Alfred Kinsey first began to do research about sex, to talk about sex?
Very much, and it's very, very odd. And it's a development, I think, that would have upset Kinsey. I mean, sex education, he felt, was vital to a proper, healthy sexual life of young people. And actually, it's been proved time and again that the things people mind about, teenage pregnancy, promiscuity, and things of that nature, are much less where there's a thorough sex education. And Kinsey knew that and advocated it.
There's a lot we're going to learn tonight, but tell us first, if you would, just who was Alfred Kinsey? He wasn't always a sex researcher. He was an entomologist at Indiana University. What had he been studying? What brought him to the subject of sex?
Yes, I mean, people don't take that in. And actually, that's one of the strengths of Bill Condon's film, that you do, in fact, get a clear idea of that. He studied something called the gall wasp far, far longer than he studied or researched sex, for about 20 years. It's a hopeless little creature. It's called a gall wasp. It can't sting and it can't fly. And Kinsey was fascinated by it. And in fact, he became the leading gall wasp researcher in America, indeed in Europe as well. And he didn't lead him to sex, that. I think it was his own very frustrated boyhood and youth, and indeed early manhood. He was a virgin until he was 27 or 28, and that caused him a lot of difficulty at first.
But of course, then he found himself in his 40s. He had mastered this wasp. He's a professor of zoology at Indiana University, restless, as I read you and others. And suddenly the professor of zoology thinks to himself, humans don't know as much about their own sexuality as we know about livestock and insects.
Exactly. It wasn't exactly restlessness. He was a restless man, but he more and more got students coming to him with problems. And he realized they would ask him questions. Because he was a biology professor, it seemed natural to come to him. He found, A, he didn't know the answers, and B, no one knew the answers. The answers being, what do people do? People would come and say, am I normal to, well, let's say it was a young man, to masturbate? And Kinsey didn't know, and no one knew at that time. And so he gradually moved to put this right. And in fact, he always envisaged pursuing both careers, the entomologist and the sex counselor. But gradually, he was overwhelmed by the sex, as it were.
I want you to take us into that classroom in 1938 to set the cultural stage for what was on the minds of students in those years, and even his own mind. But just to get a flavor of this, let's listen to a clip from the new film, Kinsey. Here's Dr. Kinsey addressing a lecture hall full of students at Indiana University.
Why offer a marriage course? Because society has interfered with what should be a normal biological development, causing a scandalous delay of sexual activity, which leads to sexual difficulty in early marriage. In an uninhibited society, a 12-year-old would know most of the biology, which I will have to give you in formal lectures. So, let's start with the 6 stages of the coital sequence.
So, there we are, Liam Neeson playing Alfred Kinsey in the new movie Kinsey. Jonathan Gathorne-Hardy, tell us about that course and how it came to be, who attended it, and what their response was when Alfred Kinsey became very explicit in the discussion of human sexuality.
Well, the people who attended it were the people at the university. They had to be, I think it was mostly graduates at first, or they had to be engaged.
And as in engaged to be married?
As engaged to be married. And actually, quite a number of the staff turned up, too. And he simply told them the facts of life, totally clearly. He illustrated them with slides. And they were amazed. They were absolutely astounded. I mean, the state of ignorance in the 30s, the male undergraduates used to go to the mortuaries. There was a female corpse embedded in formaldehyde, which was used for teaching anatomy. And they used to try and break in and see that because they didn't know what young women and girls looked like. And into this atmosphere where no one talked about sex openly, of course they talked hugely secretly, Kinsey came out and said everything straight out and showed photographs and slides. And actually what is very odd in the film is when you see a slide, one of Kinsey's, Liam Neeson Kinsey's slides of a penis entering a vagina, You are surprised today. I mean, we get an awful lot of erotic films and pornographic films, but there's something about the straightforward presentation of these facts, which even now, people who see the film will find is surprising.
I want to ask you about that. Alfred Kinsey is quoted as once saying that poets had 2,000 years to talk about love, and now it was the biologist's turn. But everyone sitting in that classroom at Indiana University in 1938 had been born of a sexual encounter, and many of them had surely had sexual encounters. What was it then? What is it now that keeps humans amazed by the common source of every human's life?
Yes, I wonder why that is. Well, partly it is because there are always people who want to stop it, to hide it, who are frightened of it, and they try and prevent any discussion. And these tides of repression and silence seem to reform as soon as they're swept away.
Alfred Kinsey broke through that in a huge way. He went on to collect thousands of sexual histories and began to publish that. It went to enormous notoriety in the United States
later. It all grew out of the marriage course, you see. He didn't know the answers, and he would say at the end of each session, each hour-long lecture, if you'd like to help this research, come to me and I will ask you in total privacy what you do. And you will help people, other people. And he gradually began to amass a lot of facts and very rapidly began to find out all sorts of things which people had never known before. And it was from that the whole thing grew.
And you're saying they had never known before, even though, Everyone was born of sex.
Yes.
There was no understanding of what of the range of normal human sexuality.
That's right. There was what Kinsey called the H figures, which were homosexuals. Obviously, people knew about it, but they didn't know how many there were. They didn't know actually what they did. Extramarital affairs, everyone knew they took place. No one knew how much, how often they took place. And the whole sort of spectrum of sexual development was unknown and was slowly uncovered by Kinsey. People, for example, it was axiomatic that women reached the height of their sexual development at about the age of 17 or 18, whereas men were at their sexual height at the age of 42.
This was presumed before Kinsey.
This was presumed before Kinsey.
So these questions, these interviews, were really the foundation of all his work right on through. What kinds of questions did he ask? How did he get people in that laced-up age to spill their stories so frankly?
Well, he was a difficult man, Kinsey. He was often aggressive. He was a bully sometimes. At the same time, he was a very, very astute and skillful interviewer. And he created an extraordinary tool in his interview. It took a year to learn. And it had about 300 questions, the normal one, and about 500 for a complex sex life. And the first 20 minutes, he never mentioned sex. He just gradually led up to it. And people I talked to quite a lot of people who'd been interviewed by him. And they said his sympathy and this extraordinary rapidity with which the questions came. And they had a strange feeling of being in a sort of bubble, a sort of isolated, taken away from the world state. And they just found themselves telling him the truth. And I think as far as one can see, that is a fact.
He assembled all of those stories, collated the research, put his findings together in two volumes that came out in the late 40s. First, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, and then Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, that collectively come to be known as the Kinsey Report. What was the public reaction when all this was there in black and white and it became an enormous bestseller?
Well, the Male Report was an unqualified and total success. I mean, it was quite often its effect was compared to the atom bomb, which had just gone off. And people were fascinated. I think if they were young, they found it a sort of erotic stimulation, even though they were very, very dense pages and full of graphs and statistics.
But the very idea that they were being written about.
And again, these words, vagina, orgasm, penis, and so on, flowing across the page, again made people's jaws drop. And a lot of money flowed in, and he became a celebrity, and that has its own sort of momentum, like a snowball. And he went on to do the Female Report, which he thought was a better book, and in some respects it is. But once again, it landed on the bookshelves with a huge sort of crash, and the reaction was totally different. I mean, America at that point could take men masturbating and having sex with each other and being unfaithful to their wives. They couldn't take it about women. American womanhood was sacrosanct. How could they do these terrible things? And there was an absolute explosion of sort of horror. Also, I think you have to bear in mind that the early 50s, 50, 52, 53, 54, were a time when the Cold War was beginning. Mm-hmm. And America, well, the whole of the West, in fact, was very, very nervous of Russia. They didn't want anything shaking the sort of stability which they were used to. And indeed, I think that's one of the reasons you're getting such a reaction with you over the film, because the same sort of anxiety is abroad.
Security threats in the air.
Security threats in the air, a nervousness about what's happening, more in America because of 9/11, but equally so, actually, in Europe.
And once again, a kind of pushback against the open discussion of sexuality Jonathan Gaythorne-Hardy, we have to take a short break. Please stand by for a moment. We're talking tonight about Alfred Kinsey and the birth of America's open conversation about sex. My guest is Jonathan Gaythorne-Hardy, biographer of Kinsey. Kinsey, Sex, the Measure of All Things is his book. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Alfred Kinsey and the birth of America's open conversation about sex, an openness that may be a bit threatened again at the moment with the cultural changes, political changes taking place in this country. But today, the new movie Kinsey comes out, starring Liam Neeson and Laura Linney. One of the advisors on that film is Jonathan Gaythorne-Hardy. He joins us tonight from Binham, England. He's author of the terrific biography, Kinsey, Sex, the Measure of All Things. We've been looking at Dr. Alfred Kinsey's life and how it exploded like an atom bomb, it was said at the time, on the American cultural scene in the late 30s, the 40s, and especially into the teeth of the Cold War and the 50s. Jonathan, I wish you'd give us a sense of the kind of behind-the-scenes life of this man. His public face was as the dry scientist, happily married, fairly conventional. But in fact, as he ventured deeper into this realm of sexual research, his life and sex life became anything but conventional.
Yes, anything but conventional. He, the thing about Kinsey was his feeling was that sex was a good thing. And provided no one was hurt, people should be allowed to do sexually what they wanted. And there should be no compulsion. He would have been horrified at paedophilia with very young children, for example.
You say he would be horrified because of the compulsion angle there.
Because of the compulsion, also, I think he would have thought, and indeed he said he would have thought it wrong. It just wasn't, mm-hmm. it isn't what sex mm-hmm. was about. Kinsey felt you couldn't ask people about complex sexual behaviors, about, let's say, the association of pain with sex, which is not uncommon, actually, if you hadn't experienced it. So he would encourage, and certainly himself, he would experiment. And gradually, he made a very close association between pain and sexual pleasure, which he explored fully. I think between consenting adults, provided they didn't hurt anyone, he felt they should be allowed to do what they want. And that applies not just to homosexuality and bisexuality, but to other things. And he, almost by chance, he came to encourage that or allow it in his team of workers.
That is, his research crew.
His research crew, who amounted in the end to about 15, I think.
Suddenly, they went from interviewing subjects to being subjects, being sexual experimenters or demonstrators on film in the privacy of his home.
Yes, and amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. They were not allowed to try and have sex with anyone they interviewed. That was absolutely forbidden. And it sometimes went wrong. I mean, Paul Gephardt had an affair with Clyde Martin. I believe we've got the author of the novel about Clyde. Had an affair with Clyde Martin's wife. And she began to fall in love with him. And Clyde Martin became very upset. And Kinsey said to Gephardt, look, you've got to stop this. The point of our freedom is not that we hurt each other. And they did stop it.
I want to hear more about how you see the way the new film interprets that, here where biology and emotions begin to interrelate in Kinsey's own research. Here's a quick clip from the film where the research associate that you mentioned, Clyde Martin, here played by Peter Sarsgaard, challenges his mentor, Alfred Kinsey, played here by Liam Neeson.
What are we to you, Proc? We're just lab rats? Is this just another part of the project? The proof that sex is nothing more than friction and harmless fun? Well, let me tell you, it's the whole thing. And if you're not careful, it will cut you wide open.
Go home to your wife, Clyde. She's going to need you.
A difficult moment there in the film. And, of course, the background here, if I've got this right, Jonathan, Kinsey's research associates were encouraged to share each other's wives with each other at one point. And Clyde Martin's wife fell for one of his colleagues and wants to leave him. But it's a great line there. If you're not careful with sex, the line, it will cut you wide open. how did Alfred Kinsey contend with that? He wanted to be, at least publicly, the strict biologist about this, arena that's so loaded.
Yeah, two things, Tom. The first, I think, to say he encouraged them to sleep together is perhaps putting it strongly. He allowed it. As to how he coped with it, the whole business, he kept it secret. He knew perfectly well if any of this came out, he was lost. So they were very discreet about this state of affairs.
I guess I mean, though, not so much what was going on in the attic and in their more extended research, shall we say. But I mean, how did the biologists deal with this enormous wrapper of emotion and passion and sentiment and emotional pain that accompanied a biological act?
He didn't deal with it. You can say that was a weakness of his research. And it was frequently criticized at the time that you can't deal with sex without dealing with emotion. And Kinsey would say, okay, but you can't quantify emotion. You can't measure love. We'll move on to that possibly. And certainly Gebhard, when he took over the Kinsey Institute, did move on to it. He said, first of all, we must make a ground base of straightforward physiological fact. Mm. And that is what I'll do initially. Whether he would have gone on to try and deal with more subtle aspects, nobody knows. But I think he was probably right. None of the major surveys which have followed Kinsey have attempted or at least succeeded in dealing with emotion. When you deal with people's feelings, you have to do much, much smaller, much more in-depth studies, and then you can begin to come to grips with it. But to do a very, very big one, it's just not susceptible to that sort of management.
And he was working on a huge scale. We're talking tonight about Alfred Kinsey. The new movie Kinsey is out today. My guest is Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy, author of the biography Kinsey, Sex, the Measure of All Things. Jonathan, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now from Baltimore, Dr. Fred Berlin. He's founder of the Johns Hopkins University Sexual Disorders Clinic. Fred Berlin, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder what you make of this whole story. Here we look back on Alfred Kinsey and are reminded he was called a pervert, a menace, even a communist. And yet, just this week in the New York Times, a big story out saying, here we are decades after Kinsey, and still it's an act of courage to study sex, that sex researchers are subject to all kinds of opprobrium and research funds being cut off if people know what they're doing, that they have to work in code. Is it odd that after all these decades, people are still working in the shadows in sex research?
Well, sex elicits very strong emotions, and although it touches the lives of all of us, sometimes we're more comfortable with our own sexuality than with that of others. It's hard, for example, to think of mom and dad being sexual, and certainly grandma and grandpa don't do that sort of thing. So there's almost an instinctual discomfort about discussing and dealing with this very private, intimate issue in a more public fashion. Secondly, it's an area of tension of the sort that often exists when there are particular moral beliefs that mean a great deal in the lives of particular individuals who are then coming up against what science and medicine is saying that perhaps challenges some of those beliefs. And this is, again, an area where that kind of tension, the Scopes trial, the Darwin versus creation, also becomes a part of it. So for these very important reasons, the intrinsic nature of sex itself is something that elicits a lot of strong emotion, and how it touches on issues of religion and morality, factors that are important in the lives of of all of us, that it's not hard for me to understand why sometimes we feel there is much more heat than light.
But odd still, in a way, that in the 30s and 40s, I guess America would have been almost universally shocked at a conversation about sex. Now we see on television, any night of the week, a conversation of Viagra and four-hour erections and Sex in the City, and still there's an aversion at some level to the open scientific study of this issue.
That's correct. And even in the face of this, I think there are countercurrents going in different directions. It wasn't too many years ago that a Surgeon General of the United States lost her job in part because she thought that there should be discussions with youngsters about the idea of masturbation. There was a study published in the year 2000 in the American Journal of Psychology suggesting that some children who had been sexually abused grew up to be okay. They weren't permanently damaged. The United States Congress overwhelmingly condemned that research. And I think what they failed to understand is that although what had happened was wrong to these kids, not all of them were harmed by it, and yet they seemed to think that getting these facts out there would somehow condone child sexual abuse. And this is another thing that runs through much of what goes on with Kinsey, that somehow by talking about issues and getting the facts out, there are those that fear that he's condoning the sorts of behavior that they, because of their own particular values and beliefs, feel are behaviors that ought not to be occurring.
And so we read that all these years later, again from the Times, saying researchers still know precious little about fundamental questions, including, they say, now, this is today, including how sexual desire affects judgment, how young people develop a sexual identity, why so many people take sexual risks, and how personality and mood affect sexual health. Dr. Berlin, as a researcher yourself, when you look back at Kinsey's research, does it look antiquated now? Does it look primitive? Where is the frontier of sexual understanding moved?
It's like looking back on any groundbreaking experience. Obviously, as time comes along, we become a bit more sophisticated in our understanding. But certainly, the idea of wanting to base opinion upon facts and evidence, which was as simple as that sounds, was a very unique idea in terms of his studying what goes on in terms of human sexuality. That's something that is still terribly important. And we still do, in important ways, stay away from that. We sometimes, for example, with children, act as though you throw a switch at the age of 18, and for the first time they become sexual. And yet we know in the city that I'm living in, there are numbers of, sadly, 12, 13, 14-year-olds who become pregnant. There are many youngsters who are sexually active. It's a developmental process that, like other developmental processes, evolves over time. And yet there are many who are afraid to sit down and talk with youngsters about their own evolving sexuality, perhaps help them with the confusion they may be experiencing, perhaps guide them. We're much more likely to lecture and tell them what not to do than to try to have a meaningful dialogue, albeit one that should be at the level that's appropriate for the age of the child in question.
Jonathan Gaythorne-Hardy, I wonder what you think Alfred Kinsey would think. In many ways, as you said earlier, he might be dismayed at progress that hasn't been made. On the other hand, here we are in 2004 talking very candidly with a professor of sexual disorder at Johns Hopkins University. I mean, Kinsey's field has become established as a significant field of study.
Yes, I think he'd been very pleased at that sort of development. At the same time, you know, Kinsey never felt that he was the major force in this particular field, or the major force of change. His own feeling was that it was the Second World War which was the great engine of change, and that possibly the spread of wealth down through society, particularly to young people. And in a way, you know, Kinsey couldn't change anything, because what he was doing, he was finding out what people did. He wasn't sort of advocating this or that. But at the same time, of course, someone who crystallizes current behavior and current hopes and beliefs does, by that very fact, influence what happens, rather as well, Rousseau in the 18th century is an example, or Betty Friedan in 1963 with The Feminine Mystique. She caught the desire for women to be freer, to have their own lives, and as a result of catching it and crystallizing it, increased it. And I think Kinsey's effect was precisely that. He found out what was happening. He put it straight out in front of people and surprised them. But he didn't sort of create it. He discovered it.
Yeah. Dr. Berlin, a final question for you, if I may. You, of course, know how Alfred Kinsey's life and research evolved and how complicated things got at the end, involved with his research staff and others. Himself cruising out into all kinds of what we'd still call kinky sexual behavior. Is it an occupational hazard of sexual research, or is it an occupational hazard of a pioneer in a field that was as taboo as sex? How is he seen in the field for those later stages of his research when they got so wild and woolly?
Well, I mean, obviously today it would be terribly important in doing this kind of work professionally to not cross boundaries and involve oneself personally into this kind of sexual activity. But having said that, I think that there is a recognition that trying to take the blinders off, trying to look objectively at the spectrum of human sexuality, trying to learn how people are behaving, getting some sense of the struggles that some folks were having in their lives and some ability to be able to help them, I think all of those are advances that have been built upon the things that that he has done. In terms of lifestyle, again, we get, I think, beyond the science. There are still people that would argue that being sexually active and having these kinds of relationships outside of the context of marriage ought not to be accepted, and there are others who feel that we ought to be much more liberal and less constrained. I'm not sure that can be resolved simply through looking at the science or medicine of this. I think those have to do with the values that we all have, but again, that somehow need to be shared and where there needs to be an open dialogue rather than simply polarizing and seeing one another as enemies and not trying to find some way of, perhaps in some instances, at least resolving those differences.
Though it's pretty hot and pretty polarized right now. Fred Berlin, thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Fred Berlin, founder of the Johns Hopkins University Sexual Disorders Clinic. I want to turn now to Santa Barbara, California. We are joined there by T.C. Boyle, author of the novel The Inner Circle. T.C. Boyle, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much for being on.
Yes, hello, Tom, and it's great to hear Mr. Gaythorne Hardy, whose book, of course, was very informative for my own novel.
And your own novel, The Inner Circle, uses the life and work of Kinsey as its meat. Tell us what you do with that in your novel, T.C. Boyle.
Well, of course, as a novelist, just part of this humble breed who makes fictions up, I'm trying to find out the why and wherefore. I'm trying to dramatize what happens behind the scenes. And what you and Jonathan had said earlier is really my point of departure. If Kinsey says that he can separate the study of sex or the physiology of sex from any notion of love, I wondered just how that might play out in a drama.
Now, I'm not sure we've fleshed that entirely out here. Kinsey's point was love is extraneous. You don't have to look at love to look at sex. It's a false pairing.
Well, Tom, as you quoted earlier, he had said, the poets have had 2,000 years to tell us about notions of romance. Now I, a scientist, will tell us about the physiology of sex without any emotional content involved. I'm wondering how that would play out. And so, of course, I've invented characters to surround him in the inner circle. This is not a Romana Clay. They're not based exactly on the real individuals, but this enables me to show, for instance, my fictional character, John Milk, one of the inner circle, and his wife, and how they might respond to being sex researchers under the thumb of a man like Kinsey.
And how did you come away feeling as a novelist, as an artist, looking into this scientist's life? Did it hold up as a whole, credible, legitimate? I'm not sure what the right word was. Was it sound?
I very much agree with what Kinsey has given us. That is, as Mr. Gaythorne Hardy said earlier, Kinsey stood for free sexual relations between consenting adults. Anything goes. He normalized all sorts of sexual behaviors. I'm all for that. On the other hand, as a novelist, I'm very interested also in the effect of a guru on a group of people. That is, a very powerful and charismatic leader, and how he might curb the individuality of his followers, the effect he might have on them emotionally. And in this case, not only was Kinsey dominating his inner circle intellectually, but also in terms of their sexual behavior.
That we have to hear more about. T.C. Boyle, author of the novel The Inner Circle in Santa Barbara, California, please stand by. And Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy in Benham, England, joining us tonight, author of the biography Kinsey, Sex, the Measure of All Things. We're talking tonight about Alfred Kinsey and the birth of America's open conversation about sex. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Dr. Sex, Dr. Alfred Kinsey. The new movie, Kinsey, comes out today, starring Liam Neeson and Laura Linney, directed by Bill Condon. We're joined tonight by a biographer of Alfred Kinsey, Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy, an advisor on that film, and by the novelist T.C. Boyle, whose novel The Inner Circle takes Kinsey's life as a point of departure for an exploration of the emotional surround of his work. Fascinating stuff. And T.C. Boyle, as you've heard, we're using a recent article that you've had in Playboy magazine as a bit of a guide here tonight, and it's a terrific one. But there's a sort of fork in the road that I want to explore with you and Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy. Kinsey says repeatedly, as I'm reading here, that studying something or talking about studying, paying attention to something is not the same as endorsing it. And yet, you kind of go through a summary of his impact by demonstrating the variety of human sexual activity, you write, T.C. Boyle. He asserted that there is no such thing as normal behavior. That opens society up to less prejudice about certain sexual practices. He said all sex acts between consenting parties were equal and equally valid. And of course, you also present him as a reformer out of the progressive era, in fact, an advocate for sex, saying his work gave rise to the sexual freedom of the 1960s. So can Alfred Kinsey say, I'm just a scientist, I'm just studying, or I guess clearly you're saying he's more than that. He was.
Of course, as Mr. Gaythorne Hardy has shown, and also James Jones and Cornelia Christensen and Wardell Pomeroy, his other biographers, his enthusiasm bled over into what was meant to be disinterested scientific surveying. It's quite apparent even from the tone of his books. He could not help being an advocate for and an enthusiast for free sexual behavior, and perhaps what pushed him in this direction was his findings, the findings of how various our sexual behaviors are, and then how morally wrong it is to try to put any prohibitions on such behavior.
Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy, we read that in his marriage course at Indiana University, he told students there were only three types of sexual abnormality: abstinence, celibacy, and delayed marriage. That left an awfully big field to romp in, much of it taboo.
Yes, quite true. And I would like just to say I'm going to buy T.C. Boyle's book, which I've heard is wonderful, and I'm really looking forward to reading it. Yes, it did, and a very wide field. And I think it's true to say he did. He was, as Robinson, one of the commentators, an enthusiast for sex. He thought it was a good thing, and thought people should enjoy it in the way they wanted to, always with the proviso that they didn't force people and they didn't cause harm. He felt, you see, that you can't call it a philosophical position, but it comes close to it. When you usually, not invariably, but usually people who make love in whatever fashion they choose, at the end feel affection and fondness, however momentary, and usually slightly more than momentary. And he saw the sexual act as a sort of factory of affection, a sort of a force in the world. And there are very few things of which you can say that people are left after it feeling fonder of each other. You can't say it of games. They're usually left feeling furious if they lose. And in a way, it's a kindly humanitarian way of looking at human beings.
Sex as a factory of affection.
Yes.
T.C. Boyle, I wonder how you finally see this. I mean, you know that this tension very much goes on. Bill Condon, the director of the film, says that there's still this idea that if you can destroy Alfred Kinsey's reputation, you can turn back the clock, you can put sex back in the closet. And a lot of Americans appear very eager to do that. They may be disparaged by some. On the other hand, they may point to the number of abortions today, fatherless children, AIDS, and say, you know, Kinsey let all this out of the bottle, and though repression has its price, it's better than what's being paid by these afflictions.
Well, judging from the results of our recent election, repression is back with us right now. But just the opposite would be true. The spread of AIDS, abortion, fatherless families would be really helped if we had more sex education. As for the idea of bringing down Kinsey or tarnishing his reputation, I really think it's pretty much irrelevant to our society. Prior to the wonderful biographies of the 90s by Jonathan Gaythorne Hardy and James Jones, no one really had paid any attention to Kinsey. To me, he was just a name floating in the ether. I first came across him as a viable subject for a novel when I was reading David Halberstam's wonderful little pop history called The 50s,
yeah.
in which he gave bios of the various figures of that era. And Kinsey's biography, as a very powerful, charismatic man who controlled a group of people, really appealed to me. You may know that I am also the author of The Road to Wellville,
right.
which deals with another figure very similar to Kinsey.
Mr. Kellogg.
He was Dr. Kellogg, yes, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. He controlled his inner circle. He was quite famous in his day. But unlike Dr. Kinsey, he felt that sex drained our vital energies.
And everyone's happy to talk about breakfast cereal.
It's yes, that's right. Breakfast cereal will buck you up and keep you from having those sexual notions which destroy your vital energies.
Jonathan Gaythorne-Hardy, we've just got a minute left here. There's this wonderful line in the Times. They say sexual taste is a wild card and one that many people would prefer be kept face down. Are humans ever going to be so free as Alfred Kinsey, where they can sit around and discuss their intimate sexuality in a wholly liberated way? Or is this permanently part of something that's half hidden, more hidden than that?
No, I don't think it's permanent. I think it's limited geographically. I mean, you can find cultures and societies historically and today in which people are perfectly happy to talk and even happier to behave in the ways they want to. France, for example, they're much more open about sex and much more relaxed about it. Italy and Spain have the unfortunate condition of being largely Catholic, which rather makes it harder for them. But no, I see no reason why, and we will change. The point is, societies are never static. I think there's no reason why at some point or other, both in England and America, and I think actually, oddly enough, at the moment, though we usually take our patterns from you, we do find it easier, and I see no reason why America won't in the future.
Mm. T.C. Boyle, last word goes to you. What do you think Kinsey would think of American sexual openness today?
I think he'd be both pleased by what we see in the internet or conversation that we're having right now, the fact that the press does and can write about sexual matters. I think he would be alarmed at the repression creeping up on us at this very moment.
Pleased at the internet? I have to ask you, do you mean pleased at internet porno?
I would think so, because it would demonstrate the various behaviors that the human animal engages in for all who are interested to see.
Well, there you go. It is a world of varied tastes. T.C. Boyle, author of The Inner Circle, a terrific novelist, and terrific to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Gaythorne-Hardy in Binham, England tonight. It's been wonderful to have you on board. Thank you very much for being with us.
I enjoyed it.
Biographer Jonathan Gaythorne-Hardy, author of Kinsey, Sex, the Measure of All Things. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Like to coo with my baby tonight. And pitch the woo with my baby tonight.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
We cannot belong to anybody who is not having his green suit, his military suit, and his kufiya. It's very difficult to think about Palestine without Yasser Arafat.
I believe we've got a great chance to establish a Palestinian state, and I intend to use the next 4 years to spend the capital of the United States on such a state.
We are going to work flat out to deliver this. But people have to understand, we can't deliver something unless the people whom it affects actually want it to happen. And we don't believe there will be a viable future for a state of Palestine unless it's based on certain key democratic principles.
The operation is going extremely well, and we will continue to press the enemy until we have, in fact, return Fallujah to the Fallujah people.
I'm pleased to announce my nomination of Judge Al Gonzalez to be the Attorney General of the United States.
The American people expect and deserve a Department of Justice guided by the rule of law. And there should be no question regarding the Department's commitment to justice for every American. On this principle, there can be no compromise.
They should be taught science, not the Bible. They should be taught the science which supports evolution. They should be taught the science which calls into question aspects of evolution. And they should be taught the science which would support alternate theories.
And there's a week, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat dead at 75. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair both express optimism that a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians can be delivered. U.S. troops launch a major offensive to retake the insurgent-held city of Fallujah in Iraq. President Bush names Alberto Gonzalez as his nominee for attorney general after John Ashcroft announces his resignation. And Evolution goes back on trial in Atlanta as a group of parents seek the removal of a warning sticker on high school biology textbooks that warns that, quote, evolution is a theory, not a fact. Chuck Beeny, there it is, from Ramallah right into our own Atlanta backyards, the world in a week.
The world in a week, and Fallujah really occupies center stage, it seems to me, for this week and possibly into next week as well. And it looks like, even as we were pushing in, military officers were admitting that the key rebels, insurgents had dispersed, and our entry into the city seemed to be, it was coordinated with uprisings and attacks all over Iraq from the people we were trying to pin down in Fallujah. You know, I was reading a Time story. You read The Marines, and then suddenly you read something that brings home to you, these are kids. There was a story in the Times about some Marines under fire in a house, and one of them yelled out, "Sir, I see a cat. Can I shoot it, sir?" And the officer said, "Absolutely not." This was an 18-year-old kid.
And when we see the pictures, I mean, it takes extraordinary courage to go up those streets, and they're having to go up them one by one by one, intense fire from house after house, from mosques. I mean, you can't get deeper in harm's way than they are right now, and they do look astonishingly young. They are, in many cases.
They are. They're as young as Holly McKeo, a 19-year-old who was killed by a bomb in Kirkuk, and she's mentioned in a piece in the Bob Herbert's column in the Times today. Her mother talks of that moment that is coming now to many American, to the mothers of too many American fighting men and women, the knock on the door. "It was the lightest tap on my door that I've ever heard in my life," said her mother, Paula Zadansky. "I opened the door, and I seen the man in the dress greens, and I knew. I immediately knew. But I thought that if, as long as I didn't let him in, he wouldn't tell me. And then none of it would have happened." So he kept saying, "Ma'am, I need to come in." And I kept telling him, "I'm sorry, but you can't come in."
Just don't want to open the door to that news. I mean, we see that determination and that bravery, and you can't help just praying that this is all adding up to something that moves closer to a solution. President Bush asserted today again that, in fact, it is, and yet, as you say, insurgent leaders out of town, trouble breaking out in other parts of Iraq. It's like the carnival game where you bang down one head and another one pops up.
Yes, and you know, the prophecy of Mr. Bush's father really rings true, that we would be the occupiers of a, quote, bitterly hostile land. And that seems to be what's happening.
But, it is impressive how these troops just do the job. We want to be sure they're asked to do the right job. And then here it is again, Jack, Evolution, still a point of controversy in the United States. All these years after the Scopes trial and everything else, that evangelical vote that we heard from in the election, that we heard from on point this week in conversations with some very interesting evangelical guests, presents itself in many dimensions, including that sticker on the high school textbook says, "Evolution, only a theory."
Yes, only a theory. And, of course, theories, as we know, are just sort of like little rumors in the mind, aren't they?
Far from it in science. They're big. It's about as big as it gets. But the language can be warped in many directions, and it's made to dismiss what so many scientists build their basic understanding of biology on. And yet, you've got a lot of people saying, "This is not what my Bible tells me, and I'm going with the Bible."
Yes, my favorite couplet on that one is Woodrow Wilson in 1912. He was asked, "What about evolution? Do you believe it?" He said, "Like every other man of intelligence and education, I do believe it. It surprises me at this late date such questions could be asked." Well, this late date, 1912.
Well, 1912, but nearly a century on, that debate goes on. The whole confrontation of belief and science really not resolved, and it looks like it could be one of the major debates of this century again.
Faith and reason. Who would have thought it? But somehow this secular world is just totally unacceptable to many people who find it without meaning and without any redeeming grace at all, and they want to shoot the world back full of grace.
Well, their voices are being heard right now. Jack, have a good and prayerful weekend if you choose.
Thank you.
And so will I. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.